The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and it's my genuine honor to introduce our guests. Judith Lewis Herman is one of the country's leading experts on the treatment of post-traumatic stress and incest. A professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, her groundbreaking 1992 book, Trauma and Recovery, The Aftermath of Violence from Domestic Abuse to Political Terror, redefined our understanding of what it means to be a trauma survivor. Dr. Herman is the former director of training at the Victims of Violence Program at the Cambridge Hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a founding member of the Women's Mental Health Collective. Her many honors include the 2000 American Medical Women's Association Award, and in 2003, the American Psychiatric Association bestowed upon her the title of Distinguished Life Fellow. A manifesto for a new framework of justice, her new book, Truth and Repair, reimagines the implementation of justice based on the testimony of survivors. Tonight, Dr. Herman will be in conversation with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, The Body Keeps the Score, a watershed examination of the ways traumatic stress affects the physical health of human beings. He set up one of the first clinical research centers in the U.S. dedicated to the study and treatment of traumatic stress in a civilian population, and he initiated the process that led to the establishment of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, a congressionally mandated initiative that now funds approximately 150 centers specializing in developing effective treatment interventions and implementing them in settings from juvenile detention centers to tribal agencies nationwide. I could go on and on, but our time is limited. Judith Bessel, we're grateful you could join us. The screen is yours.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for having us. Hi there, Bessel. I should tell the people who are listening in that we go way back.
Over 50 years?
It all kind of blurs after a while, you know, when you reach a certain age. But yeah, here we are. Maybe I could start by saying that 30 years ago, when I wrote Trauma and Recovery, my thesis was that this is a social problem, not just an individual psychological problem. Oh, I think my cat wants to join us. yeah, come on, it's okay. And that if trauma resulted into personal trauma, which is mostly what we see most, I mean, you know, there are acts of God and so on, and there are auto accidents, but most of what we see as psychiatrists are survivors of human cruelty and malice and violence. And so my argument was, this is not, as we used to say in the women's liberation movement, the personal is political. And so if this is not just a personal problem, but a political problem, and it's the result of an initial injustice, then it seemed to me that recovery is not just a matter of individual healing, but also social healing and social justice. So that's what this book is about. So if you want the cliff notes, there they are. And I guess then we'll just talk about it.
My opening sentence is, I hope that this book will be as successful as Trauma Recovery, because I think Trauma Recovery really changed the world in significant ways. It really opened up. It was the opening salvo of understanding trauma. And already then, you defined it as an issue of power and of voice. And I'm somewhat embarrassed that after all these years of doing this work, and we're almost parallel lives in this, I still am a psychiatrist, which is sort of an odd thing to be, because our profession is basically a broken profession that has lost its way. And from the very beginning, you talked about how this issue has to do with social justice. And in psychiatry, of which I'm still a part, we sort of lost our way by focusing on what's the best treatment and the best intervention and the best technique to do. And what is so beautiful about your book is you point out, no, this is a social problem about equality and about justice. And you have always said it. And of course, anybody who does this work knows that this is a very central issue. And what's also, so it's great to see you really state this so very beautifully, but it's also in a way, of course, very discouraging for both of us after having done this work for as long as we have, that we thought we were getting somewhere in terms of acknowledgement of the reality of child abuse and slavery and racism and all the things that really contributed to trauma, that I think it looks like we're in the middle of a backlash in a way. And so what is painful about your books is you have these stories about very lovely programs in various parts of the country that continue to be somewhat peripheral, and that the issue that you highlight, which I hope you'll talk much more about, is that justice is a core element of healing from trauma. And if you don't get justice, it will fester inside and your body will continue to respond as if the trauma is going on. Why don't you talk more about the issue of acknowledgement and that justice needs to be on the side of the victim and not on the side of the perpetrator. As you point out, our society is great and very good in that regard, protecting people against undue accusations. But boy, our society is not very good in protecting people who get hurt.
Well, yes, there's a lot to say about what you just said. And before we even get to the justice part and the acknowledgement part, when you talked about, you know, here we are in this psychiatric profession that really seems to have lost its way with its focus not on just on the individual, but only on the sort of biological side of psychiatry.
What's wrong with you?
I mean, you know, when I came of age, I was very lucky because two things were going on that totally shaped my career. One was the women's movement. And I was in a consciousness raising group at the same time as I was a rookie resident. And that's what enabled me to listen to my patients instead of the textbook that said that incest, you know, prevalence was one case per million. So how come I had two cases in my first month as on the inpatient service, right? But the other thing that was going on in psychiatry was deinstitutionalization. And that was actually a social movement too, a progressive social movement, believe it or not, because the idea was that now that we had antipsychotic drugs, they weren't a cure by any means, but they mitigate, they would mitigate the symptoms sufficiently of major mental illness so that people with mental illness could be treated much more humanely and economically in community settings. And I was part of, the same patients that had been on a locked unit and inpatient, at a state hospital for years, we found community residences for them and a day. I was at the team doc on a day treatment program that was wonderful. You know, they all learned to take the tea and they came and had a community meeting and an exercise class and they cooked a hot lunch and they went on trips. They were still psychotic, but that was okay. They could live in the community. But anyway, then in came Ronald Reagan and community mental health, well, they closed the state hospitals, but they didn't bother to fund the community residences and the day treatment programs. And that's when we started having homeless people on the streets and in prison. And that is still where people with major mental illness get whatever. I mean, that's anyway, I can go ranting on and on, but.
But you and I were both in different ways, but part of this whole Boston thing of the priest abuse scandal that started in Boston, and that really was good explanation, sort of illustration of what happens to the victims. Huh? That the court systems were basically utilized to protect the perpetrators rather than take care of the victims. And in your book, you write very beautifully about it. Also, how the justice process is a traumatizing process for the victims who are held to be responsible for their own issues. Huh?
Right.
And that's much of our background, isn't it? And we were quite hopeful back then, weren't we? We really thought that things would change. And you were part of the civil rights movement, as was I back then. And in the past few years, I keep going like, but I thought we settled that back in 1985. I thought we took care of that in 1989. I thought that was okay in 1995. And then we elect our first black president, and the whole world goes back to, is it any better today than where we started, for God's sake?
Well, you know, I do think that we took an enormous right turn when Ronald Reagan came in, actually. And it showed not only in, you know, in the state of psychiatry and the, you know, the ignoring of social problems and of social treatments, but, you know, in a sort of runaway capitalism. We both have a good friend who has stage four cancer, and we've been talking about stage four capitalism for a while. You know, whether you're talking about climate, whether you're talking about racial backlash, whether you're talking about psychiatry, yes, it's been a struggle. But
so, Judy, maybe you should let people know what programs you see that are useful guides for us where we should be going. They have not been as universally successful as we'd hoped they would be. But maybe you can sort of point us in the direction where you think we should be going.
Yes, thank you. Let's. I mean, there are things, I always tell people, if you're going to treat trauma, don't do it alone, because you're going to see the worst that human beings are capable of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have to surround yourself with the best. And so look for the people who are really doing amazing work. And, you know, we have been... The trauma field has been inspirational in that regard.
Oh, I mean, we meet the best of human beings.
The dedication yeah. And the commitment and the caring and the, you know, I did a training this year that was organized by a psychologist in Ukraine for Ukrainian speaking therapists who wanted to work with refugees, some of whom were refugees themselves. And, you know, the outpouring of caring and commitment and dedication was wonderful. So yes, there are model programs, and there are survivors who also make meaning of their trauma by understanding it's not just my problem, it's a social problem, and I'm going to join with others because if I can prevent this from happening to one other person, then it won't have been in vain what I went through. And so and these are the people I interviewed for the book. And for example, one of them is an attorney in Vermont named Winona Ward. She grew up on a back road with extremely violent and abusive father who beat up everybody in the family, her mother, all her siblings, and sexually abused everybody in the family. And she got out early. She married a truck driver, and while they were doing their long, they paired up to, you know, to do these long distance runs. And when he was driving, she studied for her college degree in the back of the truck. And then she got a full scholarship to go to law school in Vermont. And when she graduated, she founded a nonprofit called, oh man, I'm blocking on the name, but it's Have Justice Will Travel. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to serve people and families like hers. And she described how one of her first clients was a woman who was, you know, a victim of intimate partner violence, living in a trailer on a back road, like the way she did. Yep. And she drove, but this woman didn't have a driver's license. She didn't have a car. She wasn't going to be able to get to court. And so Winona drove out to her house and helped her get her get a restraining order and, you know, and child support and, you know, supervised visitation so the kids would not be at risk any longer. But that was only the beginning. She realized that, you know, a court's order for him to stay away, even if it were properly enforced, which many restraining orders are not.
Pretty hard in Vermont, actually.
Yeah. Was not gonna, I mean, this woman was totally isolated and impoverished. And I mean, she was a sitting duck. So her legal service included a lot of what we would call social work. Yep. And advocacy. She helped the woman find housing in town. She helped the woman get her GED. Mm-hmm. She helped her get her driver's license. She helped her get, and this I thought was just psychologically brilliant. She helped her find a dentist that would take Medicaid so she could get her teeth fixed because her husband had knocked out her front teeth. And she was incredibly ashamed of her appearance. And when she, a year later, this woman, she said she'd gotten a job in a local store in town. And she walked into the store, she said she almost didn't recognize this woman. Instead of being, you know, cowering the way the person does on the cover of my book. You know, I mean, this is the freeze and surrender response of trauma, right? It's hardwired in all of us.
Yeah.
And instead, she had her head up, and she was smiling, and she made eye contact. And you know, when Bessel talks about the body keeps the score, that's what we need. You know,
I think it strikes me is that when you and I both started in very different ways.
Yeah.
Started with peer groups. Mm-hmm. You started with our bodies ourselves.
Yeah.
Women got to explore their bodies with each other.
Yes.
And then you started with incest survivors talking to each other. Mm-hmm. Our Vietnam veterans talking to each other. Because I knew nothing about what it's like to serve in the war. And so we facilitated groups in which we learned from the people themselves what they were doing. And also, the way we started is from the moment we started to work, the people who were patients were also each other's therapists in a way. And what has struck me actually is that in the past decades or so, this whole issue of peer support and peer therapy seems to have largely disappeared. And It has all become professionalized. And now when you have a diagnosis of PTSD, you go to a new social worker who doesn't know anything about trauma, who tells you how you should think differently. But the roots that you and I had is for people to explore their reality together and to support each other, not based on how much money people would get paid for it, but by a commitment to each other to change our lives. And I think that's a very big thing missing these days, and a big hole in our society of not really being a system where people can help each other and where that's being valued and honored in a way. And when I read your book, I see, again, a bunch of people doing things to bring people together, but it has not become really part of our systems by and large.
No. Well, again, if you don't have a social analysis of trauma, then you're not going to understand the power of social connection. And yet, you know, we have tons and tons of research now that, that says that social support is the key predictor of trauma. It is one of the most powerful predictors of good recovery. And social isolation is one of the most powerful predictors of failure to recover. So you see the worst outcomes with people who are socially isolated. But then again, that too is a question of empowerment. And, you know, if you're thinking of treatment as a top-down phenomenon, you're not going to understand the power of the bottom-up organizing that goes on. Early on, we started doing groups for trauma survivors because the Vietnam veterans formed rap groups that, you know, because we'd come out of group consciousness raising groups and we understood their power. We had firsthand experience of the power of groups. And what you see in survivor groups is that people have tremendous compassion for one another and they get one another. What they don't have is self-compassion. And but we, you know, as therapists, we kind of structure things in such a way so that people are kind of challenged to take in the feedback that they get and actually to, you know, to start to internalize it and to, you know, to make that eye contact with one another. And when it comes to social justice, that's what people want. They want the recognition, they want the acknowledgement, they want the validation, and they want vindication. That every person I interviewed, and I would say every patient I've ever seen, every survivor I've ever seen, agreed that the first thing they wanted was for the people who mattered to them to support them.
And
you always start, understand them.
You always start saying, this is happening to me because there's something wrong with me. The feelings I have is because I'm crazy.
I'm bad.
And I deserved it. So profound. And I think only in a group type situation where you see other people go through the same self-blame, self-hatred, same shame, you go like, yeah, I know what you feel. I know what it's like. But you are not the person who should be ashamed of yourself. The people who did this to you should be ashamed of yourself.
Exactly.
You get that in the group where people can support.
Well, I think you do see that in the Me Too movement.
I
think you do see that in the Black Lives Matter movement. See, you know, the testimony, the enormous relief and liberation that people feel when their testimony is acknowledged and when their communities say to them exactly what you just said, Bessel, the shame belongs with the perpetrator, not with you. So it's not oh, well, how many drinks did you have? Or what were you wearing? Or what were you doing out late, you know, walking out by yourself at night? Or why did you stay with him?
Yeah.
And, you know, so that in fact, I wrote in my book, the people I interviewed were survivors of basically gender-based violence, sexual and domestic violence, including male survivors. And, you know, theoretically, these are felonies. These are crimes, violent crimes, sexual assault, battery, you know, abusing children. Those are crimes.
Yeah.
But unless it's, you know, our stereotype, unless the perpetrators are stereotype of a criminal, in other words, a Black stranger, then we don't treat them as crimes. We treat them as business as usual or personal problems or, you know, misunderstandings.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys. Yeah, basically. And so what I found was when I interviewed the survivors was that their idea of justice was acknowledgement of responsibility, not just from the perpetrators, or not even mainly from the perpetrators, but from the bystanders, from the people who colluded, who looked the other way, who couldn't be bothered, you know?
You touched on that, but I think bystander issue is a huge issue. And for many people I work with, the fact that people knew what was going on and didn't protect them was as traumatic, if not more so, than the actual acts of
violence.
Actually.
Absolutely. I mean, the incest survivors I treated were always asking, where was my mom?
Yeah.
Where was my mom? Well, a lot of times, I mean, what we found when we studied our first 20 incest cases was that this was an abuse of power. And it took place in families where the perpetrator had enormous power over the family. Incest families were often described as socially isolated. Well, isolation wasn't something that just happened. It happened because he enforced it. I mean, a lot of it was correlated with battering, domestic violence. A lot of times the kids would say, you know, he didn't allow my mom to leave the house. You know, she wasn't allowed to visit her family or her friends. You know, he would accuse her of infidelity and beat her up. She certainly wasn't allowed to have her own money. And the kids weren't allowed to, you know, have a sleepover at a friend's house.
And the question for you here, because that is really how things were in the 80s and early 90s when you and I cut our teeth. But I think social situation has changed. And women are much more empowered than they are today than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And yet I think the dynamics haven't changed all that much, which is interesting actually, that even though there's more opportunity to strike out on your own and to be less completely financially dependent, the dynamics haven't changed very much.
Well, but remember, the baseline we started from was very low.
Yeah.
So the fact that we've made progress in some domains of women's liberation, you know, we're up from making 59 cents on the dollar compared to men to all of 79 cents, you know, I mean, that's progress, but, you know, things like that. And certainly in reproductive freedom, we've gone backwards and, you know, so, and the same, our same wonderful Supreme Court with two credibly accused perpetrators on running our justice system, also just in its wisdom decided that you couldn't possibly take a gun away from a batterer because that it interferes with Second Amendment rights. And you also, by the way, can't require the police to enforce a restraining order. Justice Alito, 10 years ago, opined that even though the state of Colorado had passed a law that said police shall enforce restraining orders. It didn't really mean shall, because it was a recommendation, but it wasn't a requirement. And so survivors of a femicide, the children who survived the murder of their mother, really, you know, had no claim to sue the police who had refused to enforce a restraining order. So in terms of our justice system and violence against women, no, we really have not made much progress. I mean, for sexual assault, for example, most cases are still not reported because survivors know perfectly well that they're going to be treated like the suspects, you know, not. And
I actually discourage my patients from seeing the perpetrators.
Yeah. And then when you look at the attrition, the failure to investigate and then the failure to prosecute and so on, when you get to an actual conviction rate, it's about 1% of rape cases end up with a criminal conviction. And again, of course, rape by a stranger, particularly a person of color, is going to be very aggressively prosecuted, but most rapes are by people the victim knows. And, you know, they take place in marriage, in dating situations, at workplaces, and so on. And those cases are, the prosecution of those cases is extremely rare. So that when we talk about justice for survivors of gender-based violence or any kind of violence where the dominant group is committing acts of violence against a subordinate group, you're talking about crimes of impunity for the most part.
So Judy, what would you propose? How can we move this about? How can we, you talk about some individual programs where people are doing noble things with some effects. But I think the Kavanaugh hearing and what's happened with our previous president, of course, is very much on our minds. And the fact that, in fact, we cannot teach about slavery anymore. We cannot teach about stuff anymore in some parts of the country. What do you propose? Aside from writing your book, which is...
Well, I propose that justice requires democracy. And if you're going to have a tyranny, if you're going to have a fascist government, then you're not going to have justice. That's just how it is. If you're going to have entrenched and basically rules of dominance and subordination, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's male supremacy, whether it's Christian supremacy.
Yeah, whatever. Supremacy,
whatever. The Ayatollah, you know, if you're going to have Ayatollahs, you're not going to have justice. If you're going to have dictators, you're not going to have justice. Justice requires democracy, and you can think of justice as the way of reconciling liberty and equality. Everybody has freedom, but your freedom ends where you start infringing on the freedom of your neighbor.
Yeah.
Because then you're not, you know, once you start doing that, you're establishing dominance and subordination. So justice is fairness. Justice is equality. Justice is mutuality.
Reciprocity is the word we like these days.
Yeah.
Reciprocity is sort of the current term that we use in that field. Yeah.
So, you know, it's based, you know, on working things out and including repairing harm when you've done harm. That's the basic principle of restorative justice. And what I found was that the survivors I interested in were much more interested in repairing harm and preventing future harm than they were in punishment. They were not, they weren't big on forgiveness. They weren't big on punishment either. They were big on setting limits.
Justice.
And having the community step in and say, nope, we don't allow this. And you did wrong, and now you have to fix it.
Yeah.
And that is it is visionary.
Yeah.
But
isn't it this, the first person to have said this, people have discussed this well during the Roman Republic and the French Revolution. And I mean, this is a very old debate, but and the question is what gets in the way of actually accomplishing. There's people want to ask questions, so
maybe
turn it over to the floor. Yeah, Andy.
Hello, thank you for that discussion. We do have a number of questions.
Okay,
let's jump right in, and I'll use people's first names. Denise asks, why do you think the patterns of abuse continue and reappear, although we are more aware?
Well, that's a deep question. I think that probably the most honest answer is we don't know. Because we have devoted so little attention either to understanding perpetrators.
Yeah.
You know, we're all in on punishing, except then we don't, because they don't look like our stereotype of criminal. So, I mean, we don't even have good epidemiology, let alone any kind of in-depth psychological studies or sociological studies of what makes perpetrators tick. The few times people have actually tried to study, they end up throwing up their hands. In the mental health field, they throw up their hands. I mean, this is the psychiatrist who studied the perpetrators of the Nazi Holocaust, ended up saying they couldn't find any psychopathology,
Yeah.
And there's one study I know of that looked at sex offenders in the community, the 99% that never face any consequences. They got their, it wasn't random sample, but they got their subjects through networks and advertisements, and they went to great lengths to make sure that their data were not going to be accessible to law enforcement. And this was, they did very extensive diagnostic interviews.
It was Mary Koss.
It was at New York State Psychiatric Institute. So this was, they ended up scratching heads because these people qualified for no psychiatric diagnosis, not substance abuse, not personality disorder, certainly not major mental illness. So they just said, we don't know.
It's basically like when people talk about sexual assault in the military, they focus on the people who are the victims of the assault, but they hardly ever talk about who are the people who are doing this.
Yes.
Yeah. Really just stunning. What is it about this system that makes room for these people?
You certainly have hot spots. I mean, there was just another case at one of the bases in Texas, and where clearly, you have this frat boy culture, and everybody, that's just how it is. I mean, we know that there are social circumstances that promote it. I mean, college fraternities and athletic teams, all male groups that have hazing and sadistic initiation rites, where they actually subject the young men to them first, and then, including things like anal rape and, certainly it's kind of disgusting stuff. And then they get to do it to the next group. So you have these brotherhoods where this is a tradition and they're powerful. So I don't think you can separate the psychopathology from the social structures again.
We have more questions coming in. Inara asks, Trauma seems to be experienced by so many people in society, the trauma perpetrated by the people closest in one's life and or from the social violence that exists in the day-to-day life. With that, what are your thoughts about the statement, in order for a better society, most, if not all people, should participate in a therapeutic process to heal?
Now, do you have to, like...
Well, it depends what you call a therapeutic process. I mean, I think an educational process is certainly important. I mean, and as we've seen, it's very contentious. Do we want to actually let our children know about slavery and genocide in the history of the United States? Do we want our kids to learn about sexuality at all, let alone sexual violence? It certainly seems to be the case that young women who have participated in some form of education about the risks they face, including things like role plays for, you know, if someone is hitting on you and you want to practice how to say no, are at lesser risk. So I think getting people together in groups to learn about the conditions of their lives, you can call it a therapeutic process if you want. I would call it consciousness raising.
But the one reaction after your book is so many people have trauma histories. Let's say, let's talk about the abortion debates right now, for example. How many people have had abortions? 29 per thousand women have had abortions each year. It's extremely common. And so many women have been raped. So many men have been also been beaten up. And there is something about that people need to keep these things secret from themselves. If in response to the Kavanaugh hearing, all the senators or congresspeople who had been molested themselves would have stood up, yeah, it would have made a big difference. There is something about people not outing themselves and pretending like they're normal. And in fact, none of us are spared of traumatic experiences. And yet, we are embarrassed about our own trauma and we like to pretend like it didn't happen to us. And I think the more people become aware that this is part of so many people's lives and so many of us are coping with this, that's the beginning. And I think that's the culture that you and I tend to live in, where people tend not to be violent with each other also, where they really talk about the effect that these things have had on us, ourselves.
So Barbara asks, what does justice look like in your scheme? I'm thinking of survivors of abuse and trauma, especially where the perpetrator has died or disappeared.
Well, there are still the bystanders. And for many survivors, justice is about healing the relationship with the bystanders, where the bystanders know and where the truth comes out, that's step one, and where the bystanders acknowledge their own responsibility and take responsibility for helping the survivor heal. So it doesn't really depend on the perpetrator. In fact, Eve Ensler, the author of The Vagina Monologues, who now goes by the name V, wrote an amazing book called The Apology, where she's a playwright, and she wrote a monologue in the voice of her father, who physically and sexually abused her. And she imagined the apology that he had died, and she imagined the apology that she wanted from him that she never got during his lifetime, and wrote this amazing script in which he basically worked the 12 steps of AA, you know, a fearless moral inventory and a confession and acknowledgement of the harm he had done. And when she was done, she said it was a very painful process, but when she was done writing it, she changed her name to V because she no longer wanted to be identified by the patronymic. And she said, it was like, I got him out of my body. It was like a spiritual and physical and emotional liberation. And it was just, I was done with him. And the last line of the book is, old man be gone. So it doesn't depend on the perpetrator.
But that's a very hard issue. You know, what we rarely talk about in our work is the issue of loyalty. And that it's so important to feel loyal towards your parents and to feel like you love your parents. And for Evensa to be able to say, be gone, is an extraordinarily difficult thing for people to do. We're so programmed to be loyal to our core network that it takes an extraordinary amount of courage to say, I cannot get blood out of a stone. I cannot change this person. What happens, happens, and I need to move on. That's an extraordinarily difficult step for human beings to take because we are so much defined by the tribes we belong to. Yeah? And I think he is such an extraordinary example of being able to move into a new territory, but she's such an extraordinarily intelligent and amazing human being who's able to do that. And not everybody of that's a very hard
and
task.
And again, she did it in community. She did it, you know, as part of a movement, you know. But it is it's a grieving process, but as
a reattachment process. A reattachment process. And that's also part, a critical part of your early evolution is that the women got together, the Vietnam veterans got together, and said they formed a new tribe from which they could, and that happened with the priest abuse scandal also, how many people really found a new group of people who they feel they could belong to. But if you come to a new group, you tend to go back to the old group.
And that can happen in the justice system. I mean, you know, justice can be about the community affirming the survivor. Yep. And when that happens, you know, justice is served, but then healing is served.
So you just answered the question that I was going to ask. So I'm going to move on to another one. We've got time for one or two more. We have way too many to ask, unfortunately. Do you think pushing for healing, apology, and validation from perpetrators and others external to the victim might further empower outside forces versus focus on the victim's own self-agency?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it can go either way, but it depends on how prepared the victim is. One of the things that my colleague Emily Schesso and I have done over the years is facilitate family disclosures from survivors and sometimes family confrontations with incest survivors. And when we plan them, we ask the survivor, what's your best case scenario? What do you want to get out of this? And you know, they might say, I want him to admit it and apologize and, you know, make amends. And that's all very well and good, but it doesn't happen very, it does happen. We've seen it happen, but doesn't happen very often. So then we say, and what's the worst case scenario? And, you know, he's going to deny it. They'll say, you know, you always were crazy. You always, you know, you asked for it, or, you know, why are you whining about this now? And if she says, well, then I'd be devastated, then you say, well, then we say, well, we don't recommend that you do that then, because you're giving away your power. You're saying he has the power to determine whether it's a successful outcome or not. But if she says, well, you know what? That's his problem. I'm just going to say, you know what? I'm not keeping your secret anymore. Now you go deal with it.
You can only do that if you have people who will listen to you and validate.
Of course, yes, you can't do
it. As long as the whole world is in denial.
You can't do
it. You need to belong will trump your capacity to tell the truth.
No, you need safety and community. Then you can seek justice.
Somebody's looking for a bit of career advice here.
Yeah.
I'm an EMDR therapist, and I see all of what you shared about in my practice. As professionals with long careers in trauma work, what's your advice to stay in the field and for career longevity?
Just don't do it alone. Have good buddies. If you're isolated in your private practice, you know, find yourself a peer group. We got together in a study group years and years ago. We met at each other's houses and had little talks and, you know, shared a little coffee or a beer, and we had a community, and that's what kept, and then I had the Victims of Violence Program, which, you know, was just, I can't fail enough about my colleagues there. And so, you know, if you have a good community, you can keep going. And if you don't, you really can't.
Yeah, I think the community is the essence. I talk quite a bit about our beginnings. Mm-hmm. Actually, also Hubble liked to say, Boston was to trauma, but Vienna once was to music. You know, and it very much has to do with your and my relationship.
Had a lot to do with that, Bessel.
We will not mess with each other. And we made a very explicit agreement that we would have each other's back.
Yeah.
Even though we came from very different perspectives, angles, temperaments, we made the commitment to each other to explore this together.
Yeah.
And I think that really gave us the capacity to do the work that we have done. Yeah. And I keep telling people, you've got to get together with other people and share your failures with each other. That's one of the, not only, I had this great case, but look at what didn't work. And yes. I think both the victims of the Trump Center was very good in terms of questioning, is this good enough? Is this working well enough? And we had colleagues who respected each other well enough to say, not to say, you screwed up, you mm-hmm. should do better treatment, but to really think together about how can we approach this better? Huh? That peer support has been really at the core of both of our works.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us tonight. Judith Herman, Bessel van der Kolk. The book is Truth and Repair, How Trauma Survivors Envision Justice. Thanks again. It was an honor to have you both at the Free Library.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, hey. Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.